Chapter 2 is about water, among other things, but water is involved in all of the topics of this chapter. And water is absolutely fundamental to life, of course, which is why when we go looking for life extraterrestrially, it really just amounts to looking for water elsewhere, because if we can't find water, we're not going to find life as we know it. There's a lot of special things about water as a chemical. Several different special properties, but those special properties really all spring from the fact that water is a polar molecule. It's a, first of all, by saying that it's a molecule means that it's what kind of compound? It's a covalent compound, right? As opposed to a salt or an ionic compound, which we don't call molecules, right? But if you already know that a particle is a molecule, a covalent compound, then we can further specify it as either a polar or a nonpolar compound, right? And here, polarity once again does mean there's two different sides to it. They differ in some respect. But in this case, that difference is in charge distribution. So nonpolar molecules don't have an unequal charge distribution in their bonds, meaning, and what's causing the charge? What is the source of the charge? Well, I mean, what actually carries the charge? Electrons carry charge, and so do protons in the nucleus, right? The bonds involve just the electrons, the sharing of the electrons in this case, because that's what defines a covalent bond, the sharing of electron pairs by two different atomic nuclei. But the protons in those two nuclei that are involved in the sharing also exert charge, positive charges, right? So if there's, let me just restart and mention what you brought up, electronegativity, because this is the behind the whole notion of polarity of covalent bonds. Electronegativity is a property of any of the elements. If you look at the periodic table, you can see values. If you look at the right table, you can see values for electronegativity for each element. But what is electronegativity? Besides just a value, what does it actually mean? Well, that's more of a valence notion. Electronegativity refers to how forcefully an atom attracts those electrons to itself in a covalent bond. So when the electrons are shared by two atoms, the electronegativity of one of those atoms is how much it's trying to greedily grab those electrons compared to the other atom. Okay? And in the periodic table, there's an overall trend. It's not perfect, but the trend for electronegativity values is that they are low in the lower left-hand corner of the periodic table, and they go up as you go up to the upper right-hand corner, except for the noble gases. So up toward fluorine, which is very highly electronegative. That's how the trend goes. So not all... What this means, then, is if you have a molecule, which is, by definition, a particle in which there's at least one covalent bond, there is a sharing of electrons, but there's not necessarily an equal sharing, right? If there is an absolutely equal sharing, then you're not going to have polarity, because there's not going to be an unequal distribution of those electrons that are shared. They're going to be just as likely to be around one of the two atomic nuclei as the other at any given moment, right? And so on average, they're equally around both atomic nuclei. So there is no difference in charge distribution from one side of that bond to the other. So for instance, oxygen, which has a pretty high electronegativity. Notice that it's close to that upper right-hand corner on the periodic table. I shouldn't say notice. I'm pointing to the periodic table in your heads. Pretty high electronegativity, especially compared to hydrogen, which has a pretty low electronegativity. Well, that means oxygen greedily grabs for the electrons if it's sharing them. Even though it is allowing those electrons to spend some time with the other atom, oxygen wants them for itself. That's what the high electronegativity means. Consider an oxygen molecule, though. An oxygen molecule is O2, right? Why is it O2, by the way? Because the valence of oxygen is 2. It needs to form 2 bonds to satisfy its valence. It needs to have 2 additional electrons to make it a full electron shell, right? So that's why it's O2. But anyway, there's 2 oxygen atoms in an oxygen molecule. They're both greedy. They both have high electronegativities, but they absolutely equal each other because they're both oxygen atoms. So even though they both want them for themselves, it ends up being a tie in terms of grabbing for them, and therefore it is equal sharing. And that's why an oxygen molecule is a nonpolar molecule, despite the very high electronegativity of each atom. But in a water molecule, there are 2 covalent bonds, and they're the same kind of bond. It's a bond between an oxygen and a hydrogen. Here we have 2 atomic nuclei that differ drastically in their electronegativity values. Oxygen wants those electrons much more for itself than hydrogen does. And therefore, we have an unequal distribution of charge. What happens as a result is that the electrons that are being shared, and that's not all of the electrons involved, remember. How many electrons are being shared in this bond? 2. It's a single bond. Keep in mind, every single covalent bond involves 2 electrons. There's a pair of electrons in every single bond. But there's other electrons that are the sole property of oxygen, which aren't shown here, right? Those stay with oxygen the whole time. The shared electrons, though, are spending some time around the hydrogen nucleus and the oxygen nucleus. But unequally so, because of that drastic difference in electronegativity. So the electrons spend more time around the oxygen than the hydrogen. And since electrons are negatively charged, that means the oxygen end of that bond is going to be slightly negatively charged, which is what the lowercase delta means. Partial negative charge. It's not a full charge like you would have in an anion that keeps that extra electron permanently or semi-permanently. It's just a partial charge. Conversely, because the electrons don't spend much time, less than half of the amount of time around the hydrogen end of that bond, this has a slightly positive charge. The proton shines through more. It's not negated fully because the electron isn't there very often. The electrons. All right. So any given individual bond in a polar molecule has polarity. These are both polar bonds, and overall the molecule is polar. And that's the whole reason you exist. There would be no life if it weren't for this arrangement. Why, by the way, is this a bent molecule? Why is it not the hydrogens are spaced as far apart from each other as possible, just on a line on either side of the oxygen? Because of lone pairs. Exactly. The pairs of electrons that I said are not shown but are still there, the sole property of the oxygens. Those pairs reside at 2 corners of a tetrahedron, right? So that's why you have this bent configuration for the water molecule. And therefore, overall, the molecule has one side that has a positivity and one side that has a negativity. That's a polar molecule. All right? Well, like I said, that gives water a lot of special characteristics. For instance, it gives water a very high, compared to other substances, it gives water a high specific heat capacity. What is a specific heat capacity? Not necessarily a phase change. That's latent heat of vaporization. Specific heat capacity is the amount of energy required to change the temperature of that 1 gram of that substance by 1 Kelvin. So in other words, it's a measure of how easy it is to heat up or how hard it is to heat up or cool down. And compared to other things, water is much harder to heat up or cool down, which is why, you know, when you try to boil a pot of water, the water takes a lot longer to heat up than it would in a similar amount of oil. Oil start boiling a lot faster because it's non-polar. Another important property that it gives water is the it gives it a higher density in the solid form. I mean, a lower density in the solid form than in the liquid form, which is unusual, right? Density usually increases as you go from gas to liquid and then increases again as you go from liquid to solid. You're getting things closer together and therefore you're increasing the density, getting rid of the spaces in between, right? But that's not true for water. In the ice phase, water is actually less dense than in the liquid phase. That fact alone you owe your life to, because if that weren't true, if ice didn't float, then bodies of water would freeze at the bottom first, and they would never come to completely thaw the next year, so there would still be some ice left on the bottom, and you would add to it the next year. Eventually, the whole body of water would be frozen, and there wouldn't be life. It would never have invaded land, and animals wouldn't have come into existence, including you. Also, though, speaking of latent heat of vaporization, water has a pretty high latent heat of vaporization, which is the energy required to transform the substance from liquid to gas. This is really important here, living in such a hot environment. When we sweat, the reason we lose so much heat is because taking away those molecules of water that are fast enough to escape the liquid phase on the sweat on your skin and go into the vapor phase around you, that means you're taking the very fastest of the molecules away, right? Which means the average speed of the molecules that are left behind on your body is now decreased, slower. Slower speed, average speed means lower temperature. That's what temperature is. So that cools you. If you weren't able to sweat, you would die every day here. You need to be sweating continuously to a certain degree to cope with the high temperatures. And there's also cohesivity. Water is a cohesive substance, which means even though it's made of individual particles, the water molecules themselves, those molecules have a stickiness to them. They stick to each other slightly compared to oxygen molecules in a batch of oxygen. Those oxygen molecules are pretty much ignoring each other. They're just bouncing off of each other. They don't stick to each other like water molecules do. And that cohesivity and all those other properties I mentioned are really just due to the fact that water is polar and therefore is able to make hydrogen bonds, which are what you see here represented by these green dashes in slide 2. These are individual water molecules. And so these bonds aren't chemical bonds like the covalent bonds holding the two hydrogens to an individual oxygen. Right? Those covalent bonds are chemical bonds because the two hydrogens and the oxygen, by being bonded together, fail to be hydrogen and oxygen anymore. They're now a new thing with new properties, water, right? But these individual water molecules, even though they're slightly sticking to each other with these hydrogen bonds, aren't forming a new compound when you get two water molecules together. They're just, and that's because these are very weak bonds. So covalent bonds are the strongest bonds, like we talked about last time. But they're also important, though much weaker, bonds in biology and chemistry in general, but biology as a subset of chemistry. And so those, there's three major kinds of weak bonds that we need to talk about. One is electrostatic interactions, which are what hold ions together in an ionic bond. Now, they're the strongest of the weak ones, but they're not nearly as strong as covalent bonds. Strong enough, though, that it is a chemical bond, because when you get a sodium ion and a chloride ion together, you no longer have just sodium and chlorine, right? You have a new substance, sodium chloride, with its own properties. Sodium is a highly, highly reactive chemical on its own that you would never want to handle without protection. Chlorine is a poisonous gas that you would never want to be around on its own. But when you allow them to react ionically into sodium chloride or table salt, it's not only not going to kill you, it's something you absolutely require to live. So that's a chemical bond, even though it's much weaker than a covalent bond. The other two, though, don't form new compounds. They just result in interactions between particles of compounds or molecules. And those other two, which are the other two of the three weak interactions, are van der Waals interactions. And what's the third? Hydrogen bonds themselves, which are what we're looking at here in green. Okay, so I'll describe the van der Waals things when I get to a different picture. But notice what's happening here. These hydrogen bonds aren't forming willy-nilly. There's a little bit of order to this. I mean, they have to line up just the right way for the hydrogen bond to form. A hydrogen bond forms because of electrostatic attraction, because there is a positive end to a molecule and a negative end to a nearby molecule. That negative and positive will attract each other, just like they would for ions. It's just not a full charge here, it's a partial charge, right? So that's why when you have a batch of water molecules and nothing else, just in other words, a pure water sample, the water molecules will, they won't stay here permanently if it's not ice, but they'll line up temporarily in such a way that the partially positive hydrogen of one water molecule will be next to the partially negative oxygen atom of a nearby water molecule. That's one hydrogen bond. And so that's what causes that stickiness. That's like tiny magnets, in a sense, when these things get near each other. All right, and I mentioned cohesivity or cohesion, which is caused by hydrogen bonding between water molecules. But there can also be hydrogen bonding between a water molecule and some other kind of polar molecule, like the walls of a capillary tube. Right, a capillary tube, or if you're Canadian, a capillary tube, is just anything, any small, narrow tube, right? But clinically, we think of a capillary tube as one of these thin glass tubes, right? And what do you do with those? You touch them to a drop of blood, and the blood defies gravity, right? It goes uphill. It does that because there is attraction, because of hydrogen bonding, between water molecules in the blood and the walls of the tube. So that's what lifts the, if you think of the column of blood that's in that tube, what lifts the top molecules in that column even higher is that they're being attracted farther up the wall. What causes the rest of the water molecules in the column of blood below that surface to follow is the cohesion between water molecules. But the attraction between water molecules and the wall of the tube is not cohesion, right? It's adhesion. The only difference is that adhesion is attraction between different substances, whereas cohesion is attraction between the same kind of molecules. Well, the same thing happens in trees. sequoia trees, the largest organisms that have ever lived, tall as hell, right? They have to get water up to the top of their them just like any other plant. They have to transpire, in other words. They have to bring in water from the roots, put it all the way up to the tallest leaves where it evaporates continuously. That's transpiration. That is an enormous feat when you think about it, because the higher you get off the ground, the harder it becomes to continue to lift it. Right? When you think, if you think about your spigot at home or faucet in your kitchen or whatever, wherever you have your faucets, why does the water come out when you open up the faucet? And the answer is not because you paid the bill, but why does it come out? Gravity, exactly. There's a pressure gradient from inside to outside of the pipe, but the reason that there is maintained a pressure gradient is because of gravity. And why is there a gravitational gradient? Because the water is not coming from underground all the time. It is immediately into your house, right? But what are those underground pipes connected to? Places where the water is higher than your house. It's water storage tanks. In places that don't have hills, you see water towers, right? Like in the plains states. Here you see water storage tanks on mesas, which are higher than buildings, right? You build a tall enough building, though, like a skyscraper, it's going to be taller than the water storage tank. So you open up the spigot there, there's nothing going to come out. You have to have your own dedicated pump for such buildings to force water uphill. Well, there's no pump like that in a sequoia tree or any other tree. But there still is just as much force that has to be applied to get that water that high as there would be in a building that high. And that gives you an appreciation of how, even though these hydrogen bonds are tiny forces individually, it gives you an idea of how they can add up when you have that many of them operating in the column of water that's going up each xylem tube. It's an appreciable force. But there is a limit. Eventually you get too high and you'll form cavitation in the tubes, little air spaces, and no longer, it's like breaking the connection between cars in a train. You no longer have the engine pulling everything behind it, right? So that would kill the tree. And it might be that sequoias have gotten about as high as things can get and still get away with it. But anyway, that's all because of hydrogen bonding. The polarity of water, we're looking at slide 4 now, the polarity of water is also important in that it allows water to be an excellent and very versatile solvent. In fact, life itself is really just aqueous solution chemistry, right? Life, which is just metabolism, the sum of all your chemical reactions, is what life is, really. That's occurring in aqueous solution. What is a solution, though? It's a mixture that is made up of what two components? A solvent and some solute, or maybe multiple solutes. But solvent and solute together make up the overall mixture that we call a solution. The solvent is the thing doing the dissolving. The solute is the thing being dissolved. Well, water dissolves a wide variety of things because of its polarity, including just about any ionic compound, like table salt being shown here again. It's a sodium chloride. All the big blue things are chlorides. All the positive small blue things are sodium ions. Well, unlike a molecule, which has a definite size, an ionic compound can be as big as you want, really, as long as there's enough ions, because they're all connected to each other, which is why we don't use the word molecule for them, right? So if you have a crystal of sodium chloride, which is a compound, and you put that into water, eventually you no longer really have sodium chloride. Instead, what you have is a solution that includes dissolved sodium ions and dissolved chloride ions that are no longer interacting with each other. And the reason they aren't interacting with each other anymore is that water breaks this crystal apart, one ion at a time, and each ion gets surrounded by a little cloud of water molecules lined up in such a way that positive is with negative and negative is with positive. Remember that water has both a positive end and a negative end. So at the surface of this overall, however big this chunk is, at the surface, water is in contact with these anions and cations. So enough water molecules come along and it will pick a positive sodium ion off of the chunk, basically. And when that positive sodium ion is on its own, the water molecules will line up so that the oxygen part of each water molecule, which is partly negative, will be right next to the positively charged sodium ion, keeping it from interacting with any other ion. And the chloride ions are picked off in such a way that the water molecules that shroud it are lined up with the partially positive hydrogens pointing toward the negative chloride. So just about any ionic compound can easily dissolve in water, including the very important ions, not only sodium and chloride, but other things like magnesium and potassium that are in your body all the time doing necessary jobs. In 5, we're looking at a hydrogen bond, but one thing this shows you is that hydrogen bonds aren't necessarily between water molecules. A hydrogen bond involves a hydrogen, but not necessarily a hydrogen of water. It's a you can have a hydrogen bond if the hydrogen that you have in one of the two particles is bonded to something that has a much higher electronegativity than hydrogen itself. Okay? Now that includes oxygen, like we've talked about, for water. But it also includes nitrogen, which is right next door on the periodic table, also up toward that upper right-hand corner, therefore a high electronegativity, much higher than hydrogen. So an NH bond, just like an OH bond, is also going to be polar. And if you have an NH somewhere in your molecule, then it can it's a candidate for forming a hydrogen bond with something else that is partially negative, like this oxygen right here. The distances shown here, these are angstroms, which are tiny units of measure. But notice that the hydrogen bond itself is longer than the covalent bond, which should make sense, right? The covalent bond, part of the covalent bond strength is that the two atomic nuclei are so close together. So hydrogen bond, this hydrogen bond here is much, much weaker than this covalent bond. This covalent bond is going to stick around unless something comes around strong enough to break it. This is a fleeting thing. Hydrogen bonds are not temporary, are not permanent. They can last just a fraction of a second, but they're really important nonetheless. By the way, we call the thing with the hydrogen in it that is having the partial positive charge, the hydrogen bond donor in such a case. Notice in the case of water that one water is a hydrogen bond donor and another water molecule is a hydrogen bond acceptor, but you see the difference, right? Okay. See more examples in slide 6. All of these things have a partial positive charge on one side of the hydrogen bond and a partial negative charge on the other. Hydrogen is involved in all of these, but in all cases, that hydrogen, like I said, is bonded covalently to something that has a much higher electronegativity than the hydrogen itself. So we don't see any CH bonds here. And that's because even though carbon and hydrogen, being different atoms, don't have identical electronegativities, they have very similar electronegativities. They're almost equal. And therefore, the sharing of electrons in a carbon-hydrogen bond is almost equal sharing, close enough to equal so that we classify that bond as nonpolar. This is also in itself important because whenever you have for instance, If we're talking about molecules made of nothing but carbon and hydrogen, what do we call such things, first of all? Hydrocarbons, right. Not carbohydrates. Hydrocarbons. Hydrocarbons have nothing but carbon and hydrogen in them, and therefore any bond that you choose is going to be a bond between a carbon and a hydrogen of almost equal electronegativity. Well, actually, I shouldn't say that. You can also have a bond between a carbon and a carbon, which is absolutely equal electronegativity, right? But any bond you choose in that overall hydrocarbon is going to be nonpolar. So hydrocarbons, the overall molecule themselves, are nonpolar in all cases. There's no limit to the number of different hydrocarbons we can make in the laboratory, and a lot of occur naturally, but they're all nonpolar substances. So they don't interact with water well. They're hydrophobic, in other words, because of their nonpolarity. They make excellent fuels, by the way, which is why we're on the brink of extinction global warming-wise, because we've been using fossil fuels for long enough to mess the world up because of those carbon-hydrogen bonds that are in those fossil fuels. But we rely on that same energy density that's in carbon-hydrogen bonds in our cells, not only us, but all organisms. There's a lot of carbon-hydrogen bonds in a glucose. That's why it's a good fuel, just like gasoline is. But they're nonpolar, and so consider that when we consider lipids later. All right, slide 7 shows you that water, because of its polarity, can disrupt hydrogen bonding between non-water molecules. So this, we don't know what this substance is. We don't know what this substance is because they're not complete molecules, right? But they include an HN bond. This one does, and this one includes a carbonyl group. So there's an oxygen, there's a hydrogen that can interact by a hydrogen bond. The point here is that they will do that if that's all you have present. But if water is also present, water can disrupt that hydrogen bond and create one between water and one of them and another water and the other one. So this happens all the time. You notice the double arrows. It can go back and forth. But water disrupts hydrogen bonds, which is why polar molecules are so soluble in water. But it's also why it's convenient that your DNA is constructed in such a way that those nitrogenous bases, which are the only things in DNA that are involved in the hydrogen bonds, right? That's what holds the two nucleotides together. The two strands are held together only by these weak hydrogen bonds between complementary nitrogenous bases, right? Well, this tells you that water would disrupt that. It would tear apart the two strands all the time. That doesn't happen readily, though, because these hydrogen bonds are hidden in the core of the overall double helix, away from the water. Not completely, but more so than if they were just out on the surface. They would be disrupted all the time by the water. Okay, let's go to 8. And I mentioned van der Waals attractions before. Van der Waals attractions are attractions because of electrostatic difference, in other words, positive and negative. But, kind of self-contradictorily sounding, this occurs between nonpolar molecules. Well, nonpolar molecules, by definition, aren't negative or positive on either end, right? So why would they attract each other? Well, they don't nearly as forcefully as ions do, which are fully charged, or as polar molecules do, which are partially charged. So that means van der Waals attractions are very, very weak. But they do happen because of positive attracting negative nonetheless. If you have two atoms, these two dots are atoms, and they have electrons around them, right? I'm not going to draw the electrons, but imagine an electron cloud around each nucleus. We draw electron clouds around a nucleus because we really don't know with certainty where an electron is at any given moment, right? So we draw a cloud saying this is the possible space that these electrons can be found in. But the electron really is somewhere at any given moment. And wherever it is, that's where the negative charge is. So if it happens that the electron is on this side of the left atom, it's on the left side of the left atom at this given moment, we're freezing time, and it just happens that the electron around the right one is also on its left, then that means this neutral molecule, even though it doesn't have even a partial charge, formally, in terms of polarity, it's still, this side of it is just for this tiny moment going to be partially positive here because the negative's over here, right? And this one's going to be partially negative here because the electron is there. And therefore, they're going to attract each other if it happens to be that arrangement. And actually, it can occur that if these things start to line up just right, they can get into synchrony with respect to how their electrons are moving around the nucleus. And so that can keep them together as long as they're the right distance from each other. That's what's happening in van der Waals attractions. Nonpolar molecules are attracted to each other because of these very fleeting and tiny partial charges, depending on where the electron is positioned. This graph in slide 8 shows you that it has to be just the right distance apart for this to occur optimally. The blue trace shows you the energy involved, and anything above zero is a repulsive force, right? Positive energy here means that the two things are trying to force each other away. Well, that's what happens if you get these things too close together. You get the things too close together, and the two nuclei, each of which is positive, right, because they have nothing but protons in them, or neutrons don't add to the charge, two positives together, two nuclei are going to repel each other if they get too close together, like two positive magnets. You get them too far apart, and this effect of the electrons that I just described becomes negligible. But at just the right distance, this thing, the nadir of this, the bottom part of this trace, is the optimum distance where that force of attraction for van der Waals attraction is optimized. And so just like hydrogen bonds, these are not chemical bonds. They don't make a new substance, but they are greater than zero in terms of attraction, and therefore affect the properties of the substances. Okay, in 9, we're looking at hydrogen bonds again. Here we're looking at hydrogen bonding between nitrogenous bases, just like I was talking about for DNA. In fact, these are the four nitrogenous bases normally used in DNA, right? Adenine, guanine, cytosine, thymine. The complementarity of DNA is such that you always have a purine connecting, forming hydrogen bonds with a pyrimidine, right? But there are two purines and there are two pyrimidines. So if that were the only rule, then there would still be ambiguity. It wouldn't be strict complementarity, right? In other words, it would be adenine with either thymine or cytosine. That would still be purine with pyrimidine. And it would be thymine with either adenine or guanine. It's not the way it works, though. We wouldn't be able to have it work that way, right? Because if you just look at one strand and read that sequence, there's not just one sequence that would be complementary to it. There would be multiple possibilities. In fact, there would be 2 to the millionth power when you have a million nucleotides, which is an enormous number of possibilities. So that's intolerable ambiguity. Strict complementarity is due to the fact that it's not just purine with pyrimidine, but specifically adenine with thymine, because adenine and thymine both are able to make 2 hydrogen bonds, whereas guanine and cytosine are both able to make 3 hydrogen bonds. That's why it's always C with T and always A with G. I mean, A with T. But also the point of this in terms of this chapter is what I've already told you. These tiny, individually tiny forces, these hydrogen bonds, would be disrupted by water easily if it weren't for the fact that these are occurring in the core of the double helical DNA molecule, keeping it away from water. And even though they are individually tiny, when we're talking about millions of nucleotides along the length of the overall chromosome, that holds the things together really well. But importantly, since they're also weak individually, it allows the two strands to be separated when appropriate locally, like for transcription or self-replication. Okay, now in 10, we're looking at a nonpolar substance in the presence of water. So this could be a hydrocarbon, for instance. But whatever it is, it's nonpolar. It's hydrophobic because it's nonpolar. It doesn't want to be around the water is what the word literally means. But what's happening here is really not so much that it doesn't want to be around water. It's really that water is just trying to maximize its entropy. Okay? If you don't have any non-water particles, which isn't shown here, if you just have pure water, those water molecules have their greatest amount of freedom in terms of the number of positions they can be in. In other words, they have the greatest entropy possible, right? Entropy is disorder. When you introduce one of these nonpolar molecules, though, just think about introducing one, this top one. Ignore this one for a moment. That really is displacing some water molecules. You can think of that nonpolar molecule as being a cavity that could have been occupied by the water molecules, right? They're going to not have as much freedom. The water molecules are going to have not as much freedom, in other words. So the entropy is reduced when you introduce this nonpolar molecule. There's nothing the water can do about it if there's just one hydrophobic nonpolar molecule in there. It's there. But the entropy is reduced, right? If you add another now you have both. If water surrounds both of them, then you have even more water molecules that have lost some freedom, and the entropy is reduced even further, right? But now there's something the water molecules can do about it. They can eliminate the water molecules in between, bring the two nonpolar molecules together so that the pair as a unit has less overall surface area than the two individually did. And by doing that, you're not reducing the freedom of water as much as you would if these two nonpolar molecules weren't together. Does that make sense? And therefore, you're minimizing the reduction of entropy if you coalesce or bring together the nonpolar molecules. This is why they seem like they're avoiding water, right? What's really happening is that the whole system is maximizing its entropy, which is still lower than the entropy that pure water would have, but it's minimum for the system that exists. I'm sorry, it's maximum for the system that exists. All right? So this is why you have hydrophobic behavior. It's not really that the thing cares that water is there. It's because of this entropy notion. Well, that's called the hydrophobic effect. This whole notion that nonpolar molecules coalesce, come together to exclude the water between them because of this entropy notion, that is called the hydrophobic effect. And that's really important in a lot of biological processes, including the folding of polypeptides that have newly been made, which we're looking at in slide 11. Newly synthesized, still unfolded proteins, polypeptides, are shown as these ribbons, pink ribbons on the top. That's really all translation does, is produce the primary structure of a polypeptide, right? The ribosome its job is done as soon as that stop codon is reached. It doesn't care what the polypeptide becomes. Its job is done. But the polypeptide that gets spit off of the translation assembly line doesn't do anything until it assumes its correct three-dimensional shape. All proteins, regardless of their very various functions, have that function because of their shape, their conformation. So they have to fold up properly. Sometimes they don't, by the way. Happens fairly often that it'll fold improperly. The cell recognizes that, destroys the protein, and starts over. Still has the blueprint for how to make it, the gene, right? But you have to make it on its own. But often, it does automatically fold up into the correct three-dimensional shape. Even though there's nothing really guiding it, it's not like a proofreading mechanism. The information actually ends at the translation stage. The information was in the messenger RNA. The information ends when you make that primary structure. But because of that primary structure, and because of all these three interactions that I've talked, actually all four interactions, covalent bonds plus the three weak interactions, electrostatic interactions, van der Waals forces, and hydrogen bonding, all of those contribute to the way in which these amino acids that are part of the polypeptide interact and therefore affect the overall shape of the polypeptide. And that's why if you translate the same messenger RNA multiple times, you make multiple identical copies of the same kind of polypeptide, they will all end up, or effectively all of them, they'll all end up just naturally assuming the same three-dimensional shape, because the same sorts of things are trying to come together or repel each other based on these forces we've been talking about. Okay? Sometimes, though, there can be two alternatives that don't have very much energy difference, and that's how the wrong path can be taken. If it's almost as easy to be in a different wrong configuration than the right one, just the thermal heat, the thermal energy of the environment is enough to force it into the slightly less likely shape. And that's when that one has to be destroyed. Usually, though, the things go right. Okay, 12 now. This is a table. It must be two slides long, is it? Yeah. It's all one table in slide 12 and 13, but we're looking here at functional groups, and you guys have all had organic, right? It's a prerequisite for this. So you've talked about functional groups before. This is by no means an exhaustive list of functional groups. You get a longer list in organic itself. But these are particularly important functional groups in biology. But what makes a functional group? Well, a functional group, first of all, remember, is not a molecule. It's just a part of a molecule. It's just some group of atoms hanging off of a bigger molecule. It's part of a molecule. But it's called a functional group because that particular arrangement of atoms gives that overall molecule a certain property and therefore a certain function. And so that's really, these functional groups are really the business ends of the various molecules that work various ways in a cell. A single molecule can have multiple functional groups at the same time, of course, right? So, some functional groups are hydrophobic, and there's many possibilities here. But what would you expect to be the atoms involved in hydrophobic functional groups? For them to be hydrophobic means that they need to be nonpolar. We're talking about organic compounds. What are the two most likely atoms involved? Carbon and hydrogen. In other words, hydrocarbons. Functional groups, even though the overall molecule might not be a hydrocarbon, if the functional group is just carbons and hydrogens, it's going to be hydrophobic. And the most easy one to find is a CH3, right? A methyl group. By the way, notice it says aliphatic versus aromatic. Aliphatic just refers to a non-ring structure, an open chain form, in other words, no ring, whereas an aromatic compound has a ring, which is why it's represented here. Notice that also that each of these functional groups has an R. What does the R actually stand for? What does it stand for? Well, yeah, that's what it stands for in an amino acid. You could also use that terminology here, but really, what does it actually stand for as a word linguistically? It stands for residue, which just means the leftover, everything else, in other words. So R can represent whatever you want. It's just the rest of the molecule or the residue. The functional group itself is what's connected to R. Hydroxyls are really important, an OH group, which don't have to be written to the right of the molecule, right? There's really no directionality when you get in to a solution. So you could also write a hydroxyl in any other direction, right? You could write it like that, for instance. But you would never write it as this, right? OH dash. Why is that wrong? Right, and why doesn't it bond to the hydrogen? Hydrogen has a valence of one. It can only form one bond. It's already forming that bond with the oxygen. The oxygen's valence is not satisfied unless it's forming two bonds. The other one is to the residue. Okay, anyway, what do we call compounds that have a hydroxyl group in them? They are alcohols, and therefore they end in OL to tell you that they're alcohols, like ethanol, the drinking alcohol. Isopropyl alcohol is also, it's called isopropanol. There's all kinds of alcohols, including glycerol, right, which is a constituent of triacylglycerols or triglycerides or fats. It has a glycerol. Those three hydroxyls that are in that, it's a triple alcohol, those three hydroxyls give three opportunities for attaching to something else, in this case, fatty acids, right, to make the overall fat. In the next two, you have a carbonyl group, which is a carbon double bonded to an oxygen. And there are two major possibilities where for a carbonyl group to appear. And they're non-overlapping, they're mutually exclusive. So either the carbon that is part of the carbonyl is at an end of the carbon skeleton. And I say an end because with branching you can have many ends to the skeleton. Or not. It's either at an end or it's not. It's somewhere inside the skeleton. And that defines the two different types of compounds that include carbonyl groups, aldehydes and ketones. And if the carbon is terminal, which you see here in this schematic. So there could be, this R includes other carbons, but this carbon is at the tip of one branch. Then we call that thing an aldehyde. If it's not at a tip, you have carbons on either side of it, in other words, then it's a ketone. And I used to confuse these all the time until I realized something alphabetically, and this might be useful to you if you can't keep track of them. Aldehyde, the word starts with an A, and A is at the tip of the alphabet, whereas K is in the middle of the alphabet. Ketones involve the carbon that is not terminal. But they behave differently, and we'll talk more about those when we talk about sugars, for instance, but important functional groups. A carboxyl group also really contains a carbonyl, but we don't usually call it a carbonyl in that case. A carbonyl that has an OH also stuck onto that same carbonyl carbon is collectively called a carboxyl group. And things that include that are called carboxylic acids, which can also be called organic acids. They're called organic acids because typical acids don't involve carbon, right? Like hydrochloric acid, no carbon in that. It's inorganic acid. But carboxylic acids always contain carbon because a carboxyl group has to have carbon in it. So they're called organic acids sometimes. They are important for various reasons. including the fact that every amino acid has a carboxyl group in it, which is why part of its name is acid. An amino acid is called that because it has an amino functional group, which is the next one down, and it has a carboxyl group, so it's both a carboxylic acid and an amine. We therefore call it an amino acid. But the amino group, notice, is an NH2 stuck to the residue. And that one's important because whenever you have an NH bond, you have polarity, right? We just talked about. So both of these top ones are involved in every amino acid and therefore every polypeptide and therefore every protein. Phosphate group, we'll be talking much more about when we start talking about energy relations, but you already know it's important in energy-carrying molecules, right? Because the phosphate group appears thrice in an ATP molecule, right? Twice in an ADP molecule. But what do we usually... We don't usually draw this whole phosphate out, right? We usually abbreviate it as just P when we're talking about ATP, for instance. Just always keep in mind that that P is not a phosphorus atom, which is also P. It's a phosphorus atom with four oxygen atoms also associated with it. And this one's, of course, important because of charge, but also when you get multiple phosphate groups connected together with a phosphoanhydride bond, that's what temporarily stores the energy in an ATP molecule. And then sulfhydryl groups are very similar to what other group? What are they most similar to? SH is most similar to what other group we talked about? Hydroxyl, OH. It's just an S instead of an O, and that's, it's not just that it's only off by one letter. If you think about the periodic table, where is S? In the same group as O. It's right below O, right? So sulfur and oxygen are similar, and therefore SH and OH are similar in their properties. One immediate importance of sulfhydryl groups is that they are found in cysteine amino acids. Amino acids differ from each other, of course, in that fourth position on the alpha carbon, right? It's the only thing that makes different amino acids different from each other is that R group or side chain. Well, in a cysteine, that side chain includes a sulfhydryl. And that's going to be really important in the overall conformation and stability of a polypeptide that includes multiple cysteines. Not all proteins do, but those that do means that non-adjacent cysteines, so they're in different positions, they might be really far from each other in terms of the primary structure, will come together when the thing folds. One cysteine's sulfhydryl will lose its hydrogen. The other cysteine's sulfhydryl will lose its hydrogen. That will allow the two sulfurs to bond to each other in a covalent bond, which is very much stronger than all the other three weak interactions, right? So that locks this protein into place very well. Gives a lot of mechanical strength to the protein itself. We call those disulfide bridges, right, between cysteines within a polypeptide, or even between polypeptides, you can have two cysteines interact. Okay, those are functional groups. Now, 14, we're looking at some acids here, and there's different ways to define acids, but one way to define an acid is as a substance that, in the presence of water, will dissociate into a hydrogen ion and whatever is left over. Right? In other words, in solution, an acid will donate a proton. Proton is another name for a hydrogen ion, right? Depending on how many hydrogens there are that can dissociate, we can classify acids as being either monoprotic, one proton being donated, diprotic, or triprotic, as you see here on the left. Triprotic acids are going to be H3 something. Monoprotic acids are going to be H something, and so on. But what we're looking at on the bottom is a pH scale. And a pH scale is just one example of P scales. There's all kinds of P scales. So in the remaining minute, let me just explain pH to you in case you have forgotten. First of all, the pH, any P scale is a logarithmic scale, not a linear scale. So whatever size one step is on the scale, the next step above it is 10 times that size. And two steps above it is 100 times the size of the original one, and so on. It goes in powers of 10. But what is pH actually defined as? pH equals what? The negative base 10 logarithm of the hydrogen ion concentration, right? This is all really based on water and its ability to auto-ionize. Meaning that if you have nothing but water, although the vast majority of those water molecules will remain as water molecules, at any given moment, a tiny fraction of those water molecules will turn into ions. If you have two water molecules, and one of them loses its hydrogen to the other, that means you're going to form one that is an H3O plus, right, a hydronium ion, and the other one's just going to be an OH negative, a hydroxide ion. All that's happened here is that one of the protons, one of the hydrogen nuclei of the water of one water molecule gets put onto the other one, taken away from one and put onto the other. But we can also simplify this and just think of one water molecule separating into just a hydrogen ion on its own and a hydroxide ion. Okay? Now I'm going to go over by about 30 seconds, but let me just say this. In pure water, it's experimentally shown that water will auto-ionize in this way to the extent that the concentration of hydrogen ions in pure water, because of this auto-ionization, has a specific value, right? And what is that value in pure water? Hydrogen ion concentration in pure water equals what? 10 to the negative 7th molar. That's just a measurement. Okay? Just the way things happen to be because of chemistry. But that negative 7 is the basis for why that's the middle of the pH scale. The way logarithms work is that the logarithm of 10 to the something, 10 to the x, is just x, right? Therefore, the logarithm of 10 to the negative 7th is negative 7. Therefore, the negative logarithm is just 7. P scales are made to be the negative log just so that we don't have to deal with negative numbers. Okay? But that means as you go up on the scale, that really means a decrease in the concentration, right? Because 10 to the negative 8th is actually 1/10 as concentrated in hydrogen ions. It's less concentrated, but it's going to be a negative log of 8, so you go up in the scale. That's why it's centered on 7, though, simply because that's what water does on its own.